Welcome to the latest edition of Return of the Hack, the podcast from E92+. I'm your host, Neil Langridge, and I'm delighted today to be joined by Pascal Guinens. He's the Director of Threat Intelligence at Radware. Hi, Pascal. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Neil. Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Thanks very much. So one of the kind of topics that we want to kind of discuss today in terms of kind of current trends in the threat landscape, in particular, Radware, you've just kind of recently released your kind of 2024 threat research report. And there's a kind of a lot of really interesting findings that it'd be good to kind of dive into. But kind of if you want to kind of start a little bit, if you want to kind of give a bit of background about yourself, your role at Radware and kind of your involvement in the report that's just come out.
Yeah, sure. So I'm the Director of Threat Intelligence. That means that we are looking at the global threat landscape, mostly trying to identify who are the attackers, what kind of tools are they using, what are the changes in the threat landscape, how are attackers changing their tactics, techniques, which kind of attacks are important to our customers, which vulnerabilities are coming up, and that might be of importance to our customers. And that's mostly in the area of DDoS attacks, of course, is one thing. And then the other area is application and cloud attacks that we're monitoring. So whenever we see changes or whenever we see new vulnerabilities or new important topics come up, like a hacker comes out with a new tool, new attack tool, or a new DDoS for hire service comes out, so a booter stressor service that is being published, and we see that there is an increased risk for customers and also for the larger security community, we will write reports on that. Might be an advisory, might be a blog. The report that you referred to is the yearly report where we take the information, all the data that we have from our clouds, and where we compile and try to find trends, what is changing compared to the year before, how much more attacks are we seeing, how fast are they increasing, and also, more importantly, which kind of attack vectors are we seeing increasing faster than others?
Okay, yeah, no, that's perfect. So, I mean, kind of, if you can kind of give us a bit of a view into the headline findings that you found in terms of, you know, kind of what the biggest threats are, what those kind of trends and changes have been over the last 12 months.
Yeah, sure. So in 2023, so we're talking about the year 2023, of course, going forward, it moves pretty quickly. But what we saw in 2023 is that attackers are moving up the stack. And meaning what we mean by that is saying that they're moving up in the OC layer in terms of the attack vectors that they're using. So we used to see a lot of DDoS attacks on layer 3, so leveraging volumetric attacks, trying to saturate the bandwidth towards an organization. But as more organizations move into the cloud and as more organizations have websites and an online presence, we now see that the attackers are leveraging that and are actually targeting that specific website. So they do layer 7 attack, mostly web application, web services. There's also a whole lot of APIs out there. So most of businesses that provide an online service, they might depend on payment services, for example, and they will use a third-party API for the payment services. So APIs are a very important part of that threat landscape as well. And that's all moving to the layer 7, to the application layer. So we see less and less volumetric attacks. They're still there, of course, but we see a whole lot of increase in the application layer. And not limited to web applications, but there's also another one. And that brings me to another trend, which is hitting where it hurts the most. It's going after the infrastructure that provides that online experience, which is DNS. So the domain name service is the cornerstone of every online business. If your DNS is not there, nobody will be able to connect to your website. Even your communication, if you have voice over IP systems, they will not work. Remote access will not work because your domain name cannot be resolved. So attacking the DNS is a very, very interesting part of the attacks that we're seeing, because if you bring that down, that impacts the whole organization, not only internally, but also externally, and all the customers that access that website or the organization. And those attacks also used to be more DNS amplification that we saw. So leveraging a DNS server as a reflection server to amplify an attack towards another victim. But now we also see more often layer 7 DNS attacks. So that's query floods that we see. And that's a relic from the past, because people who have been in this industry for a while now. In 2016, you had the Dyn DNS attacks by Mirai. And that was also what we call a water torture attack on the Dyn DNS. So that water torture attack, we see it coming up much faster now. So compared to the year before, we see like 3 or 4 times as much DNS queries, and more specifically water torture attacks, coming after our customers than we saw the years before. It's ramping very fast, and it's a very interesting vector to look at and to be aware of. If you have a DNS system, you need to make sure that is duplicated. So the other part that we then see also related to the attacker themselves is making it more convenient for themselves by shifting to the cloud. So the same as businesses are shifting to the cloud to have elasticity in compute, to have an easier management of their servers and their services, attackers are also shifting to the cloud, and they are hosting their attack nodes in the cloud, and they can build up clusters. They can elastically expand their clusters if they need more capacity. They can reduce them to reduce the costs or the total cost of ownership if they need to. They can use tools that are already existing, like Terraform, Puppet, Chef, Ansible, whatever tool that we're using already in business to deploy nodes and to deploy updates. They can easily update their attack vectors and their software. So they have a lot of convenience by shifting to the cloud. And related to that shift to the cloud, of course, you might say, yeah, but if they're operating in the cloud and they're attacking, they're easy to identify. You just go after the source IP that's been attacking you. You file an abuse with the cloud provider. And at that moment, the cloud node is taken down. Well, now they have a solution for that. They will use anonymous proxies. So there's lots of commercial services out there that provide like hundreds of thousands of different anonymous proxies where you can proxy layer 7, like web DDoS attacks through. Also layer 3 attacks can be routed through SOX proxies. And every day they rotate like 35% of the IP addresses. So even though that the attacker only has a couple of very capable cloud servers out there, maybe 3 or 4, it seems from the victim's perspective that the attack is coming from hundreds of thousands of different IPs. Because for every request that the attack node is sending, they're choosing a different anonymous proxy. So they switch proxy on every request that they're sending to the application. So it looks like an attack that comes from hundreds of thousands of different nodes. But those nodes are just proxies. Others might be using the Tor network, so using the dark net to put their attacks through. That's typically more for sophisticated attacks. You wouldn't do high bandwidth and high speed packets or high speed requests through the dark web, because the dark web is pretty slow. However, you can leverage it to conceal your position, and for the most sophisticated attacks. And then, of course, another trend that we see coming up is attackers using the generative AI, so GPT and LLM, GANs to some extent, not to perform more sophisticated attacks, but actually to gain an edge and to be more productive, the same way that we are doing. So we are also using generative AI for some articles or for our job, to make our job easier, to make it faster, to automate some things. You can see attackers doing the same thing. So they use it to craft better English, better phishing messages, automate some phishing messages. They don't have to put a lot of time in there to do the phishing. We don't see them often use it to generate payloads yet or to automate attacks. But I'm sure that this is only the start. So AI has been a big shift last year. If you look at CES earlier this year in 2024, in January 2024, not a single product that will come into our home will not have AI embedded. Yeah. So AI will be something that is coming into our life, whether we want it or not. It will be everywhere. When we look at AI agents being intelligent on your phone, building their own context, that's where it starts to be more dangerous, and where we might see attackers getting a more important part of that for attacks itself. So those are like the biggest trends that we saw.
Yeah, I think it's kind of touching on firstly some of the bits that you talked about at the start, and that movement to the cloud. Obviously, it's kind of, you know, as with all these things, we'll come on the fact that it, you know, these things can be a bit of an arms race. Obviously, organizations moving to the cloud, and then the bad actors. But in terms of moving that from, you know, a lot of kind of applications or kind of on-premise networks, moving that out to the cloud, moving DNS They're having more applications online. That presumably has opened up more attack vectors. Obviously, it's a much broader attack surface now that organizations has to defend. Is that kind of what's other than the obvious kind of like there's more points of entry, and has there been any other impact on how organizations have to defend because everything's a lot more public and everything's now just covers a much broader area?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is the biggest challenge that organizations have today. It's their attack surface just exploding. Because they suddenly have those cloud, they have on-prem services, they have APIs that they're using. They might be writing their own software. So they're tied into an ecosystem which provides development modules, which opens them up to supply chain attacks. There's a whole range of new problems that comes for them when they move to the cloud and when they increase their attack surface. And the biggest challenge today is not as much staying up to date with what attackers are doing, but is keeping control of that attack surface and making sure that all the services, each service that you have in that attack service is patched and up to date with the latest patches. We saw lots of vulnerabilities come out in 2022 and also in 2023, 0 days that were being abused by ransomware groups. Those vulnerabilities that were 0 days, well, they were in a lot of companies, and that's hard to, you cannot 100% be secure, but you have to keep track of what you're exposing on your threat surface. And the best way, in my opinion, to do that is when you have red teaming or when you have pen test services. Those people can map out the whole attack surface because sometimes you're not aware that some services are running. There might be a development team that spun up a cloud instance where you're not even aware of. And that's where most of the data breaches and data leaks came from, because they uploaded some real live data. They just put it there without the proper permissions. And then it's open to the public and somebody else can come and just fetch that information. Well, the CISO was not aware because he was never informed. So being able to do pen testing and red teaming that goes a little bit further than just thinking out of the box, thinking like an attacker, and trying to find all the resources related to a company can help a lot, and go far away in covering that threat surface. And as we go forward with all the APIs that we're using and all the third-party tools, and then add in AI, which will be also a lot of APIs that add on top of that, moving information to the cloud in different parts of clouds, storing confidential and sensitive information, that threat surface will become much more important. And I think that this is the biggest concern for most of the CISOs out there, is how is my threat surface? Do I make sure that all the products in my threat surface are patched in time? Because the time between breach and the disclosure of a new vulnerability is shrinking a lot. We see on average, we see between 12 and 24 hours between the disclosure of a major vulnerability and then attackers starting to abuse it. And in case of 0 days, yeah, of course, they're already abused because we found them, because an attacker was abusing it. Also, with the geopolitical threat landscape that we are in today, there's lots of tension on the geopolitics, so different countries, with what's happening in Ukraine and then also what's happening in Israel, different wars, the world breaking apart in two big blocks, where you have the Western side led by the US, but then also you have the whole BRICS countries, which is Brazil, Russia, India, and there's a whole other lots of countries, even the Middle East, that are looking to joining BRICS, that want to have that counter block against the Western countries. That causes a lot of tension. So what I see now is that on the state level, we are almost moving into a new Cold War, and that's mostly a cyber Cold War. And that fits into the AI as well, because AI becomes an arms race. Not only an arms race in technology between global cloud companies, but also a technology between nations, and especially on the military side of things. We already saw a lot of bans of technology going into China, from the US, and I'm assuming going forward there will be even more technology constraints too, because yeah, AI is advancing very fast, and there's a whole discussion out there about AI being a threat to humanity. I would not go as far as that because that's maybe looking a little bit too far in the future. But for sure, in military development, AI is a very important technology. And yeah, you don't want to give all your secrets out to your biggest opponent, of course.
Yeah, the geopolitical aspect of it does make it a little bit more complicated because yeah, we use kind of like obviously war terminology around things like kind of arms race and all of this sort of stuff in terms of the kind of bad actors out there. But it has got increasingly great, the geopolitical element around it, the fact that you know we can maybe touch on the elements around kind of hacktivism as well that. You know that makes it more complicated because if you know you're defending against a you know maybe just a normal cybercrime who's just they're interested in money, it's a little bit more straightforward. It's kind of you know they're going to be difficult, they're going to be hard to defend against, but you kind of know what they're after. They're after data information that they can exploit. When they're just looking to cause damage, I imagine it's a lot messier and it's a little bit more complicated to be able to understand what they're going to be going for, and potentially maybe you know is it a different form of tactic as well that they're going to be looking to compromise their target organization?
Yeah, absolutely. Attacks do not come out of a void. You know, there is a motivation behind an attack. There must be a motivation. There is a reason why somebody is targeting you. And that might be, as you said, financially driven. And we saw that with ransomware attacks all over the world and increasingly even in the last couple of years. But that geopolitical state that we're in, that caused a lot of troubles and caused a lot of motivation for attacks. Especially from pro-Russian hackers, that after the invasion of Ukraine, you saw that the IT army of Ukraine created a new group, a new way of performing a kind of cyber attack and adding to the whole war by doing cyber war, by calling up volunteers across the world and asking them to help them in a cyber war against Russia. So to fight propaganda, basically, that was the initial state of the IT army. So that's the government creating a new platform on Telegram, using social media, using Twitter, but mostly Telegram, to call volunteers around the world to join in, perform DDoS attack on Russian targets. Now, of course, for every action, you have a reaction. So then we see the pro-Russian actors, and that was in the beginning, was mostly with Killnet coming up and gathering several hacktivists from Russian origin that started attacking Western targets. So whenever a Western country or any country for that part was saying something bad about Russia, they found themselves as a target of a DDoS attack. So groups like Noname, for example, they have military precision. I'm not saying that they're related to the military of Russia, but they have that every day. They're performing between 10 and 15 different DDoS attacks on targets. And that information is who they target is based actually on media information. So somebody, a president in France, for example, Macron says something, okay, I'm going to support Ukraine. Well, you can expect the day after that Noname will go target France. The same for UK. If somebody in the UK announced that they're going to support Ukraine or says that they're going to put sanctions on Russia, you can expect Noname to be there the next day or the next couple of days and start attacking any website or any service in that country. And it's not only government. Government is, of course, a very interesting part to attack because what they want to do is they want to create chaos. They want to send out their message. So a hacktivist is very noisy. It's also one of my favorite threat actors because they're easy to track. They put everything public. If you compare that to a
It's a
nation state
promotional
actor,
exercise, isn't it? They want to tell everyone about what they're
yeah,
doing.
exactly. So they're actually divulging their information, and then they want volunteers to help into attack. So they will share their attack tools as well. Like Noname, Noname is a kind of a botnet, but it's what we call a crowdsourced botnet. So Noname builds a software client that can be downloaded by anyone in the world and run on their PC. And once you start to run it, it will download a curated list of attack targets that's curated by Noname itself, depending on who they want to attack today. And that bot will start doing attacks on all those different targets that the Noname operators put in their command and control server. So that's how the volunteers work. They can download it to their PC, they can download it to cloud instances running Linux, they can even download it to their Android phone and install the APK and perform attacks from their Android phone. And those are all layer 7 web DDoS attacks. So it's web-based encrypted HTTPS attack, so they always go after a website. But they're clever in the way that they go after the website. They don't just bang the website on the front door. What they go do the day before they stage the attack vectors, they go look at the website and they try to find the web pages that have most impact on the backend of the website. Like, for example, if you have a search capability that searches a database, they will leverage that and they will do many searches with random data. So to put a big load on the backend of the database, if they find a post form, like, for example, every government has a feedback form for civilians. If they find that feedback form, they will use that form and they will create an attack that does automated posts and put in random variables in that post. What? And they randomize the variables in such a way that they actually look like legitimate data to a computer. For example, if they expect a phone number, they will put in a 15 random digit number. If you expect an email, they will put in a random email. If you expect text, they will put in random text. So their attacks are so sophisticated that they look like legitimate requests. And that makes it much more difficult in terms of mitigating, because now you see a lot of bots from around the world, from volunteers, all of a sudden submitting post requests to that website, and that brings down the backend if you don't have the software that can detect and make the difference between legitimate and illegitimate requests. But they look almost completely legitimate because, yeah, they are generated as such based on research. So that was one of the first time that we see an attacker actually doing deep research into a web application and trying to target those pages that have the most impact on the server itself. It used to be that all the attackers were doing were finding the domain names and maybe the IP ranges, and then they just trash the IP ranges with random data and cause a volumetric attack or even carpet bombing attack. But really going after those pages specifically, that was something that we saw new coming from Lonin. And that's from the hacktivist side, of course. And as you said, yeah, they're very loud. So whenever they have an attack, they will always go out on Telegram and post that today we're going to attack this country. And that's the reason, because this person said that, or because we found out that there's money going or weapons going to Ukraine from that country. So because of that, we're now attacking the following targets. And in the beginning, those targets were just public websites. Websites without too much impact on business processes. It was still very visible. So I would not say that I hear sometimes people say, yeah, it's just a website with information. We don't care about that. If it goes down for a couple of hours, this has no impact on our business. Well, yeah, it does have an impact on your reputation though. Yeah. Plus it feeds those attackers, because those hacktivists, they bring down a website, it comes in the media, and all of a sudden, a lot of people see that media article and then they start joining those hacktivists because they become more popular. And then they increase the number of volunteers. They also increase the capability of performing attacks. Same thing with Anonymous Sudan, for example. Anonymous Sudan came out of nowhere in January of 2023, started attacking Sweden and Denmark because of the burning of the Quran. So that was a religious kind of motivated attacker. But because he was attacking Sweden and Denmark, those were the same kind of targets that a pro-Russian attacker like Killnet was looking for. And Killnet built a big brand around himself in the first year of the war in 2022. So in 2023, he saw those attacks from Anonymous Sudan and he said, yeah, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, right?
Yes.
So he said, yeah, I'm going to take Anonymous Sudan and I put them in the Killnet cluster because they are attacking Sweden and Denmark. And just because of Anonymous Sudan being part of the Killnet cluster and then starting to use that Killnet branding, you see the following on Telegram going from a couple of hundred of people following the Anonymous Sudan Telegram to hundreds of thousands, just in terms of a couple of weeks. So this one rose very quickly, and that's just because of the branding and the power of the media and also the power of those hacktivists to show the world what they're doing and what they're all about. And you see it also on the targets. So in the beginning, targets were just public websites, but now more and more you see them attacking ticketing services like bus ticketing, so that people train ticketing, so that people cannot get train tickets anymore. Whenever there's elections, you might see attacks on the election statistics websites. So they go after websites that do have an impact. Payment providers or their banks, financial institutions, of course, will also be attacked. But it's not limited to that. But those are the more impacting ones. And we see that more countries are starting to suffer actually from those attacks, instead of saying that, yeah, it's just an attack, not really that important. Well, yeah, it starts to have some, starts to demonstrate some impact there.
Yeah, and I suppose it's kind of good to take a positive from it in a way. Does this mean that there is more engagement between government institutions and government cybersecurity services, like kind of, you know, like GCHQ and the NCSE in the UK and Europol and things like this, and obviously the NSA in the US, working more with businesses? Because I mean, previously there will be a little bit around at the high profile, and we talk about things like obviously critical national infrastructure, but there's more obligation, I think, maybe now to have a closer integration. And maybe what we consider to be critical national infrastructure, we might think of utilities, power stations, but actually you gave an example, like, you know, if you have ticketing systems for, or the bus network went down, or, you know, kind of food services, or kind of, you know, whatever, traffic, like all of these things might not be as, we might not think of it as being critical as if somebody attacked a nuclear power station, you know, to pick an obvious example, but actually affecting fundamental everybody's kind of working life or just normal days. Our definition of what's critical, I suppose, is expanding, and governments need to kind of get a little bit more hands-on, maybe.
Yeah, I think that the industry itself, so the security community and the security industry, was well aware of all the threats that we are facing after WannaCry happened, and seeing what can happen through those malwares, and also finding all those vulnerabilities in IoT devices, and then more importantly, in everything that's in this industrial IoT and everything that's connected, power stations and nuclear plants and water supplies. We were all well aware that there was a lot of issues there and vulnerabilities and direct connectivity that should not be there. Governments tried to do something about it, but I think that most of people's eyes were opened after the war started, because now they see that there's a real threat out there that will and might be leveraging that against the citizens of a country. And we have several examples of that already happening, with China having backdoors in different plants and in different organizations. But China, for sure, is one of them, mostly spying, but also Russian actors. And the danger of those hacktivists, and we should not forget that also in the West, so people are joining the fight by doing DDoS attacks. So somebody in the US, a teenager in the US, might download a bot from the IT army of Ukraine, and the IT army of Ukraine has lots of tutorials explaining how you can get free access to a Google instance and run that Google instance and install, download a bot and perform attacks to the targets that they are saying. Let's not forget that DDoS is illegal. The authorities use the double standard. It's like, yeah, when you do it for the right reasons, for the right ethical reasons, it's okay to perform DDoS attacks. But at the same time, they were still taking down booter and stressor services, or DDoS for hire services. So DDoS is still illegal. And an actor like a hacktivist in Russia, okay, they have free play. They are attacking Western organizations. So For the Russian government, that only suits whatever strategy they have, because they are causing chaos in the West. And that's what they want from a Russian perspective, from Putin's perspective. But nothing stops Putin or the Russian government or Russian GRU, for example, to go step up to a hacktivist and say, hey, you know, my friend, what you've been doing here is illegal, even though it was done against other countries outside, but it's still illegal. I can throw you in jail unless I give you a list every Monday and you're going to target those. And there were already signs that this was happening with ransomware operators as well. Ransomware operators who are getting a lot of money in, well, they don't pay taxes. So there is an impact on the government. So the government can easily go to them and say, hey, my friend, you're getting a lot of money. You're not paying any taxes. How about you keep the money as is, but you feed me information. So instead of just encrypting the other site, you steal information and you send that information to me, because I can do something, especially when it's medical information. It would be nice to know if some politicians have medical conditions. That might be something that we can use in a propaganda campaign later on, to send out Twitter messages when something happens, to discredit a public opponent in the government of a foreign nation. So nation states can now leverage those and can also hide behind those, because the attacks that we saw performed by the GRU at the beginning of the war in Ukraine, they were performed through a public booter and stressor service that was hosted in the Netherlands. So they just bought themselves into a tier of an attack tool and use that attack tool to perform attacks. But by doing so, they are very much capable of building bigger botnets. We saw VPN filter in the past, which was a really big botnet from the operated by the GRU. And they have lots of capabilities that can go beyond any booter stressor service that's available out there on the market now. But by leveraging a, let's say, underground commercial service, they can hide who they are. So the most important for a nation state, opposite of a hacktivist, the hacktivist wants to show who he is and wants to get branding and reputation and show what he can do. A nation state is just the opposite. They don't want anyone to find out what they're doing. So they can easily be hiding behind those hacktivists and perform attacks between those hacktivists. And those hacktivists are causing a lot of chaos and trouble. And yeah, attacks can easily slip under the radar if you have those attacks going on from hacktivists.
Yeah.
Or even controlled by nation states behind those hacktivists.
Yeah, it's a much more kind of complex area. And from an investment perspective, obviously, kind of, you know, actually, obviously, cyber crime is, you know, itself funding in terms of, you know, whether they're getting it from kind of, you know, extortion or obviously kind of ransomware is a or just kind of straight out fraud with business email compromise or whatever it happens to be. But, you know, we're also seeing, touching on that kind of on the AI piece as well, that kind of whether it's activists or whether it's cybercrime, even investing in their own GPTs as well. I think that's when we talk about the discussion on AI, we think about, you know, especially from a, you know, kind of a normal person's perspective, we think about the AI that we all know, the gen AI, the tools that and AI has obviously been around a long time, but the kind of the public experience of AI, if you like, is much more at the forefront. The fact that they're building their own models and tools, I think, is that seems to be raising their capabilities up to a whole new level. And you know, as well as being able to exploit the consumer ones, it gives them a huge degree of control, presumably, over what the technology could do for them.
Yeah, so it's a two-part question. So to come back to the first part is the funding of hacktivists, because as you said, you have cyber criminals out there who are out there for profit. They, of course, they do extortion, they gain immediate money, and they can invest it in their technology. Hacktivists, on the other hand, they are not extorting any of the victims. They just go after victims. So where do they get their money? One is donations, so from volunteers, from people who like their cause. The other, of course, is advertising. The same way that the big cloud companies became big, well, those hacktivists also become big, because imagine you have a Telegram channel, you have more than 100,000 followers, and those 100,000 followers like to perform devastating attacks against their enemies. So somebody who is exploiting a DDoS for hire service or a booter stressor service where you can pay like $20 per month to get access to an interface where you can launch a DDoS attack on any target that you want, except for a Russian target. Of course, they will filter those out. Yep. But any other target that you want, that's your direct market that you're looking for advertising. So you see a lot of hacktivist advertising booter and stressor services. Anonymous Sudan, for example, the last couple of attacks that he did, he was always referring to Infra Shutdown. Before Infra Shutdown, he was referring to the Skynet Godzilla botnet. And even in the latest attacks that he has been doing, he always said attack performed to it, Godzilla or Skynet or Infra Shutdown. But that's actually doing advertisement. And I'm sure they get money for those advertisements. Killnet was one level further. He even had somebody who made jewelry. So Killnet branded rings, Killnet branded earrings, Killnet branded neck chains were being sold by this jewelry artist in Russia. And half of the proceedings went to Killnet because he used Killnet as a branding. Right. So that's how hacktivists can make money. So it's donations, it's advertising, and then other kinds of things that go around it, like proceedings of leveraging the brand for jewelry or for other things. Now, coming into the second question, how they leverage generative AI. So the easiest way to leverage generative AI is, of course, go to a ChatGPT and start asking it things. But as ChatGPT or Gemini or Bard or whatever is fancies your access for generative AI. In the beginning, those prompts had no guardrails, so you could pretty much ask them anything, like what is the best way to kill my wife? And it will give you a whole scenario, right? So then they found out that that's probably not good that we give everybody access. So we're gonna build some guardrails here. But those guardrails were not put inside the model. Those guardrails were a layer of filtering before you go into the model. So typically they will not answer what is the best way to kill somebody and get away with it. No, that he would say, no, I'm sorry, I cannot answer you. However, somebody then comes up with what we call a prompt evasion, and prompt hacking. So what they do is, well, I'm writing a book and I would like to know the potential scenarios of how it is possible to do a murder and get away with it. And then all of a sudden the AI starts to answer that. So those guardrails have evolved a lot because there's a lot of work on those guardrails. So going out into a public LLM and just putting in prompts, you might be blocked by those prompts. So you're limited by what those guardrails allow you to do. However, those models, those LLMs, the big compute and the big task of a AI, of a neural network, is actually the learning. So you need to learn that model. And once that model is learned, it's actually learning means tuning millions of parameters between all the different nodes in a neural network. Once you have all those parameters, you just send an input, you get an output. You're not changing the parameters anymore. You're not tuning it anymore. Of course, you can have some preceding and putting some context, but the model is basically fixed. So actually, if you can get a copy of the model and a copy of the parameters that go on top of that model, you can run your own LLM.
Yes.
And you don't need a lot of compute for that because even that can run on a mobile phone. So now we have neural chips, so we have AI chips and AI hardware that can sit in a phone that can run a whole neural network on the phone in hardware, and then you just put in the right parameters, and that's actually configuring that whole model to be able for you to talk to. So you can download that model, you can download the parameters, and then you can run your own LLM on your own PC, and then you can create your own context. And with a context, that means that, for example, when you go to ChatGPT or to Gemini, you always give it a certain context. You say, look, I'm working on a paper. This is what I think. This is what I see. This is what I want to write about. And then you do your prompt itself. Then you ask, now write me a blog about that, or write me a social media post about that. So that context will change the way that ChatGPT is answering. Now, this context is leveraged by bad guys to create models that are very good at creating evasive malware, for example, or that are very good at writing specific phishing messages targeting CISOs. So what they do is they download those LLM, they preseed it with context, and then they sell those services again on the underground. Other attackers are just using LLMs the same way that we might use it, is to increase productivity. Like, okay, go out and fetch all that data, and with that data, tell me what is the most important parameter that you see changing, or which is the most juiciest target that I should target next, so they can improve their attacks in that way. Going a step further, there's already tools out there for pen testing that are using AI, and typically those tools are not using generative AI, but they were using GANs, generative adversary networks. So what a GAN is actually two neural networks. One neural network is like generating, so it's like Stable Diffusion that is generating images, or it's generating attack payloads. And then the other network is actually the defender. His job is to detect malicious payloads. So what the generator will do is generate a payload, send it to the network that does the detection, and if it does detect, then the generative network will regenerate a little bit, change the payload, and it will go through that cycle until it finds something that the detector cannot detect. So that way, they can automatically generate new payloads that can pass detection. So GANs are one way that we see applied into pen testing. Another way is everything that's genetic algorithms. So algorithms that improve themselves by cutting pieces of one algorithm, putting it to the other, like you do in genetics. You cut bands and you put it in another gene. So you do the same with programs, and you can generate a program that can perform a new attack that nobody ever thought about, but it's completely automated. So, but those take a lot more knowledge about AI. So it's not as easy and as accessible as the generative AI that we see with LLMs. However, those have been very successful in pen testing. Now, lucky yeah. for us, for that pen testing, it's very chatty. So it does a lot of things. And yeah, if you have a protected website with a WAF that has a little bit of a behavioral detection, you will soon see that there's somebody trying to do bad things and trying to get information to build an attack on you. So it's not that effective yet, but it might become in the future. So GANs are certainly something that I see in the future might have an impact. Now, another way that attackers can use AI is for learning, getting there much faster. So if you want to develop, for example, a script, and if you're a seasoned developer, okay, you're not going to go to an AI to help you to write a script. However, if you have no clue how to do scripting, so script kiddies out there want to create an attack tool, but they have no clue how to. Well, let's go to ChatGPT and ask it to write me a script to perform a DDoS attack, a volumetric DDoS attack, leveraging DNS against a company. And ChatGPT, ChatGPT, not because they have guardrails, but a private GPT will tell you, well, yeah, you just do this with Python, you use this module, blah, blah, blah. And you try the script, it doesn't work the first time because, GPTs are not perfect developers. So you have to go back, you ask him, hey, I saw this error. Oh yeah, I'm sorry. So the model typically will be very sympathetical and will say, hey, I'm sorry. Yeah, I oversaw that. You have to change this into that and then do that. Okay, so you can get to a working script. Now that script will not be sophisticated. It will be a basic one. If a sophisticated attacker will not get more smarter with a LLM. However, the ones who have no idea how to do it all of a sudden become more sophisticated. So what I see is actually a shift in terms of number of attacks from before. The biggest part of the threat landscape was with the unsophisticated, what we call the script kiddies, the ones who have no clue how to perform an attack, but will use public source or tools that are made available by other more sophisticated actors and use those tools to perform attacks. But there were very simple attacks, unsophisticated. I see those shifting more to the middle, meaning that they become more sophisticated just because they can use an AI. So it's actually a shift in the sophistication of attacks. Now, the maximum sophistication is not changing. So we did not see any generative AI yet creating an attack that blows our mind and that we have to say that, oh, this a sophisticated actor with an AI will be able to push his boundaries and become even more sophisticated. No, that we don't see. But what we do see is those that are unsophisticated and have no clue how to do something, they can leverage AI to become better and to do it. The same way that people who have no idea how to program, they use GPT as a learning tool.
You
can ask it questions, it's interactive, it's a very fast way to learn. So it's a very good tool for that. So the same for bad actors. So we don't see any strange cases that we don't see in the world that we in the benign world, I would say.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because it kind of typically when we're talking about AI and a lot of the things that we're talking about with the kind of Venn and the general news, that what AI, the messaging around the potential, both from a good and bad perspective, is it gives scale, it automates, it takes the hard work out of something so people can do the high level activities and it can make stuff easier. But actually a lot of what you're talking about, it means that bad actors can be much more bespoke. They can build their own tools. They can be much more specific. They can target those threats. It actually enables a lot more kind of granular targeting, bespoke attacks, specific to the individual organization that they want to take down or they want to compromise. So actually, it's the devil in a way is in the detail in terms of what AI is enabling them to do. So there is definitely a scale benefit, but it's actually being really, really specific in a way that previously would have taken too much time and resource to be able to do.
Yeah, that is also why we call it an arms race. So for people who sit on the opposite side being attacked, it is not about getting more sophisticated security and being able to block more sophisticated attacks. It's more about the number of attacks that is coming at them.
Yeah.
And moving away from the very, very basic level of attacks to mid-level of attacks. So actually it's the volume of attacks that they need to take in. So, and that's where we see the arms race. So you have to automate your security to fight the automation of the bad guys. So it's more about productivity. But going forward, I don't have a crystal ball, so I cannot talk about it. And there's a whole lot of discussion by experts that are way above my level. I'm referring to Sam Altman and Elon Musk and so that are talking about the AGI, so the artificial generic intelligence, and then SMI, which is superhuman machine intelligence. Once we get to that, we are building AIs that are smarter than humans and that can think more faster than humans. Then we get into that range where I would say that AI can generate more sophisticated attacks than we humans would ever be able to invent. But then we're more in a dystopian future where we talk about Skynets. I don't want to go there.
We've got a lot of people
talking about that more than enough already.
Definitely. And then just one other thing that I kind of wanted to touch on, I thought was interesting that kind of came out of the report, was the different sort of attacks against different kind of verticals and markets. So, you know, kind of DDoS kind of specifically, or finance and tech was, but transportation was more about kind of application API. I suppose that the kind of, is that more in terms of the kind of the supply chain and the infrastructure, or is it more about the objective of the attack and what they want to get out, or is it kind of a combination of factors?
Yeah, it's more about the objective and the motivation. Of course, an industry that's much more digitized will, of course, have much more opportunity to being attacked. So if you have the ones that are pushed much more into digitalization, a small shop across the road will not have a website. Well, they will not be that much concerned about being attacked on the cyber side, because they only have a static website. However, a bank that does payment transactions and accept those from customers that are online, or a cryptocurrency provider or exchange, those can be hacked more easily, because there's lots of information out there that might be useful, or money that can be stolen. So it's much more about the objective. And that's where we see the difference in the types of attacks being leveraged, and also the type of actors that go after those industry, and also why we see a difference in industries. So when you look at finance, for example, I think that there, in terms of DDoS attacks, it's mostly disgruntled or extortion that they will try to leverage against financial institutions. Also hacktivists, of course, because they like the fact that it's a big name that they go after to show that they can bring them down. It gives them a lot of reward. If you think about medical institutions, there's lots of information inside that might be of importance. So there you will see ransomware actors targeting them to extract that information, and nation states being interested of getting those research facilities, where you have nation states that are interested in hacking into to get the information out of research, education. Then there's also the military. So all of them are targets, but it's always a different objective. And that's what makes some differences in verticals, that you see certain verticals being more targeted by specific type of attack. Now, the hacktivists have a pretty much level playground. They don't care very much about what type of vertical you're in. They care more about the visibility and the chaos and the outreach that it will take. So if they can go after a media website, they will be happy to bring down a media website, because a lot of people are trying to access it in the morning. Medical facility, if you need a doctor, well, I don't know the full number of my doctor anymore. I don't know the full number of my wife anymore. So
no,
we are becoming so reliant on our technology. But my wife is in my local address book. However, the phone number of a chiropractor or another guy that works in the hospital is not in my phone, because I know I can find it on the internet whenever I need it. So, but if they bring down that website, then people cannot get to the phone numbers anymore. We saw that happening in Denmark, where at some point there was an attack on a central medical website that brought together all different kinds of medical facilities and had all the information on their public websites there. That one went down, so they had to bring up another website and point all the people to that other website through Twitter to tell them, hey, go to this website if you need to know the number of your doctor. Most of the time when you go to the doctor now, you also make the appointment online. So you cannot make new appointments. You cannot check up on your appointments. Was my appointment accepted or not? When do I need to be there? Who do I contact? Yeah, it's all that information is down. So even a website that looks benign and no information being stolen can still have an impact on people. So medical would also be a target. So there's some subtle differences between all the different verticals, but it's mostly because of the motivation that you will see a difference in what kind of attacks they're seeing or how big the threat is and what kind of threat it is. So there's a big threat for everyone because, as we said, with AI automation is there, nobody is safe.
No.
If you put something online, it will be hacked at some point. It's just a matter of time. It's not a matter of if, but it's a matter of time.
Yeah.
Whether it's the more visible it is, the sooner that time will come. And depending on the vertical and what information you store on there, and it might be another motivator that comes into it.
Yeah. And then just to kind of finish off the final point, in turn, it kind of leads on nicely in terms of if it's on the internet, then it can be compromised. Things are increasingly on the internet around operational technology, IoT. You know, are you seeing those kind of that sort of infrastructure being targeted? Because obviously previously that was all hidden behind, you know, big industrial systems or infrastructure or kind of whatever, you know, kind of industrial equipment previously wasn't connected, whereas now it is connected, it's on a network and it's potentially on the internet. Is that increasingly an attack vector as well for bad actors? And obviously I suppose for hacktivists as well, because that's another area where they can make a big noise.
We did not see a lot of hacktivists actually going after those OT. There are some of them that are doing it, but very unfortunate, as you said. Yeah, it is like that OT is typically connected to the internet, and that comes from the day where we still thought that an IP address was a good password. Those were the days where I'm old enough to remember that time, and actually that made sense at that time because an IP address, it's three numbers between 0 to 55. It's a good password. Four numbers between 0 and 255. It's a good password, right? So, but nowadays, when you can scan the internet, the full internet IP range, the IPv4 IP range, in just 1 or 2 hours, it's not a good password anymore. And unfortunately, a lot of those operational technology, people thought that, okay, I just put it on an IP, but I don't put a host name behind it, so nobody will find it. Oh yeah, now they easily find it. You just go to Shodan, you type in the query, and Shodan already did it for you. So there's those IoT search engines that are gathering information all the time and who are going around all the IP addresses, extracting every little bit of information. And those OT devices sometimes were protected by It's remote desktop. It's with the username password and typically admin and an easy to guess password. So brute forcing is also easy to do. Some other OT operational technologies have a website, and it's enough to know which kind of device it is to guess the admin password, so you can get access to it. We all knew that this existed. So as I already remarked earlier in our conversation, we all knew that this existed. It's just a matter of time, and we have to make sure that we secure it. But the war breaking out and more geopolitical tensions bring that up to the forefront. So now it's becoming a real risk, because now there's somebody out there who might want to leverage that and to use it against the people, to use it in cyber warfare. So hacktivists, also the same. Yeah, if they can find that information, they will put it out there for sure. And they might even communicate it because they see it like a win. They have some very interesting information. Let's send it to the government and show them how we are helping them in winning this war. So all of a sudden, because of geopolitical tensions, all that ground that is out there, all those vulnerabilities, all those open websites, all those OT systems that are connected online without security, are now becoming much more under scrutiny because they can be abused at any moment. And they can be a powerful weapon. If you have water filtering, for example, you can always change the mixture that goes into the water and poison a whole city,
Yo.
electricity. You can cut the power of electricity. It might be really bad in the middle of the winter that you don't have any electricity for heating for a couple of weeks. And even, yeah, living without electricity, I already have a major headache when my electricity goes out for 10 minutes because I cannot
Yeah.
access anything. I have to go to my mobile phone and do everything on mobile phone. We're so connected and we're so dependent on technology that we cannot live without electricity or. So yeah, it's an important part, and it's something that governments know very well they need to solve. That's why
Yeah.
we see a acceleration in the number of threat advisories that are being put out by those governments. You have them in the US, you have them in the UK. They're putting out several advisories. Hey, protect against this, and also against DDoS attacks. You see all kinds of different advisories,
Yes.
and also more programs where they make governments report back onto what attacks are happening, but also what security they put in place, what kind of devices they're using. If they're manufactured in China, typically in the US, they might not be a good plan to put in a government. So they might have to change some of those appliances. So you see a lot more engagement from governments to secure that part, but it's still in a sad state. We still have a lot of relics from old that are sitting there.
Yeah.
And coming back to that, maybe a closing statement. If you think that we had a problem, so IoT like 6 years ago, we had MirrorEye hitting, and that ignited the whole IoT. Everybody started searching for vulnerabilities in IoT, and of course found them. Whenever you put the focus of a security researcher or a bad guy onto something, they will find a problem there, and we'll be able to abuse it. So we are still sitting with a whole IoT problem. That IoT problem is not out the door yet. Whenever
No.
you bought a device, it needed to be connected. So when what we call the smart device, when we went to the shop and we buy a smart device, what we bought was not a smart device. It was a connected device, and probably a stupidly and badly secured
Yeah, right.
connected device. Now, starting this year, we go one level further. We're actually buying smart devices because they have AI embedded. There's an AI agent in everything that we buy. For some reason, it's impossible. It will be impossible soon to find a toaster without an AI agent in there and making decisions for us. So think about it. If IoT was already such a big problem, now we're adding smart with AI on top of that. So we're moving into a much more, lots of troubles that might be caused by AI going forward and AI agents. I think especially the AI agents, when we all have it on our phone and we use it to talk to our phone. We will put private data in that AI agent. Okay, you might say it's not connected to that central AI that feeds the parameter into the agent, so it's private, but it's a treasure trove for anyone who's able to access it. So
Yeah.
that will be a big target going forward. All the personal assistants needing access to everything, getting smart devices like a malware instead of just an info stealer that steals your passwords today. You might have an intelligent malware that is an AI agent that knows that, oh, he went to that website and I saw that he has 1,000 crypto on that exchange. And I see that he has some credit in this web shop as well. And he uses that password. And so you can compile all that information locally and then only share what is interesting to the attack and say, hey, here's an interesting target because he has 1,000 in crypto. He has a couple of thousands in other credit cards over there in this shop. And I found that he's using this shop and that has this vulnerability. So go ahead and go take it from him. And that can all be done locally. Before, we needed to take all that information, extract it. And you needed a CIA level building with storage facilities that run in the petabytes to store all that information and then run big data on all that. Now you can do it with an AI agent, something that runs locally on the machine. And the machine, probably the PC from the person that you're targeting, the consumer, will have all the hardware because we all have a graphics card for gaming. Well, it
Yeah.
runs as well for AI. And soon, Intel and whatever other manufacturer of chips that will be dominant in the desktop and in the laptop will have AI acceleration on board.
Yeah.
So we're just feeding into that market and malware with AI. I think that it has a very plausible future, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know whether we might have to stop referring to everything as being smart because I'm not sure that I need that conversation with my toaster. And
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to get smarter. It's getting something, but it might not be that. So It's appreciate we've kind of come to the end. It's been an absolutely fascinating conversation. I really appreciate it. I think what I always like to kind of finish on is a bit of a takeaway for our audience, whether they're kind of a channel partner or someone working in an IT team at an organization, in terms of some of the insights and the analysis coming out of the report, in terms of having a one thing that they should do, or a kind of a takeaway, or kind of a first action to be able to learn some of those lessons to help secure either their customer or their own business moving forward. What would be the first thing that you recommend people kind of have a look at in terms of their IT infrastructure?
For me, the most important is people being aware of the threat, knowing that the threat exists, and making sure that you try everything to close that threat. So mitigate the threat. You know that you have websites, you know that they can be vulnerable to application attacks. Identify them, make sure that your threat surface is under control, that you know exactly what goes in, what goes out, where it is located. But for me, most important is being aware that it can happen to anyone at any moment. Because that's mostly what I see. It's not like the attacks are most sophisticated. And not only that, it's also through social engineering. So that's another attack vector that you need to cover as a company. So by making, not only you need to be aware, the security specialist or expert or the CISO, but also all the employees in your company need to be aware of potential phishing, potential abuse that they might get. Because it's the most of the biggest attacks that we saw in breaches were not that sophisticated. They were typically a phishing and or somebody was paid off to plant something, and then it went on from there and escalated. So awareness for me is like the most important part. Being aware of the threats that are out there, following what's happening in the threat landscape, have a good idea of where are the most important. Because as we talked about verticals, depending on the vertical and the motivation, might be a different threat actor that comes at you, might be a different threat. So depending on that, for everyone, it's the risk is different. So you need to do your own risk assessment. You need to have your own. But being aware of the threats is where it all starts, I think.
That's perfect. Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate and the insights that you brought. I hope everybody at home very much appreciate your time listening. Don't forget, provide any feedback that you'd like, and don't forget to look out for the next episode in the podcast series as well. But for now, Pascal, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It was my
Thank you.
pleasure. I had a really fun time.
Thanks.
Thank you for
Bye.
listening, everyone.